Welcome to the Think It Isn't Until It Is podcast. I'm Finn.
I'm Tim.
I'm Guy.
Chapter 8, 2014, sometime towards the end of 2015, I imagine, where we talk about the extensive Hard Believer tour and what happened when we released Hard Believer.
Absolutely.
Which happened pretty much 10 years after we started, in a roundabout circle of life type of a way.
Yeah, I mean, it was next level shit in a way.
It was next level. I mean, 10 years sounds like a long time and a not long time at the same time, doesn't it? Sometimes.
Yeah.
But our first demos in 2004 that led to the sort of touring that we did in 2013, 2014, 2015... It was kind of, I think maybe we thought maybe we'd get there a lot quicker, but then we didn't really realize what we had no idea what we were doing in 2004. And like we said before in a few other chapters, a lot of bands go from first demo, first single to massive touring.
Yeah, yeah.
And some bands are completely ready for that and just launch into it and are amazing. But a lot of bands falter, rack up a ton of debt and die at that point. And I think it really suited us that we'd taken thousands of baby steps to get to this big tour level. And so when we got the big tour, A, we were ready for it. B, we knew what it meant. And C, we kind of knew what it was going to take out of us to do this.
Sure.
And not just the whole kind of like, you can't get hammered every night and do this tour type conversation when you're our age. You can when you're 20, I'm sure. But also the kind of like, you know, when you're a little bit older than the other bands on the circuit, you might have families in tow, you might have other commitments back home, which also takes a bit of juggling, as I'm sure you guys had to navigate quite seriously at that point.
Yeah, I remember particularly because it started with the promo for this album was pretty heavy. And this is one thing that had to happen. And I remember we had this whole trip planned to the United States for a week of playing school night and doing KCRW again and doing all sorts of LA promo. And it was just things like that are just such a nightmare because you think, I can't do it that week because there's this. And I remember having to ask our manager to move this trip. I remember with bated breath saying, please, can we do it the following week? I know it's going to fuck everything up. And then eventually they said, yes, you can. And it was such a relief. You know, so there was things like that all over the place.
I mean, it is difficult, and it's hard to imagine it maybe for people who get paid every month. But when you look at a 6-month tour, you don't get paid at the beginning. You get paid when the profits have been done at the end. Normally that takes 3 to 4 months after you get back for your accounts to get finalized. So somehow you've got to find a way to cover your bills for 9 months in advance.
Sure.
You know, and that's not easy. And in a way, this is where a lot of musicians fall into the kind of drought and flood financial problems, because just like you're living like you're on the bones of your ass shit poor for 9 months, and then you get a check with 3 years wages in it in one go, and it can be really hard to handle. But I mean, one of the things about the Hard Believer tour was that in the spirit of doing everything differently, we decided not to do Europe first. We decided, right, you know what, instead of treating America like a an afterthought. We'll do America when we've done the Europe. We thought, right, you know what? We're going to do the promo run in Europe, which I'm sure we did. We did the promo business in the capital cities and stuff real quick. But
a few festies and stuff.
And we did a big old festy season up front, which was great. That was just the timing of everything, I think.
Yeah.
And so after that festy season, which was wicked, man, Boardmasters and Ziggur and just some great
Lowlands,
Plissken with Chris for the first time, and all these great festies. Oh yeah, Lowlands was amazing that year, wasn't it? It was a banging one. It was a cracker of a
gig. Was a good one because it was the day after Pukkel Pop, so it was like we were really ready for it, you know.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, we've talked in the previous chapters about our early slot Lowlands thing. So was this the second time we did the early slot Lowlands thing?
Yeah, and I think we voluntarily did it this time.
Exactly, but the downside with this is the day before we did Pukkel Pop, which is a big-ass festival in Belgium, right, I think? Is it in Belgium?
Yeah.
And so it meant that off-stage to on-stage was only about 10 hours between the two gigs, including the travel. So we were still a little bit maybe, you know, hungover. Felt like we'd just got off. I don't even remember changing clothes. I think I literally slept in my clothes and woke up the next day and then loaded in and did the gig. I mean, it was full on.
Absolutely, which is where the picture of us comes from, where we're standing on the ramp to go up to the Lowland stage, looking dishevelled.
Dishevelled,
you know,
is putting
least.
It mildly.
I look like I've just been dragged out of a hedge.
That looks like we'd just done the gig. We hadn't actually got on stage yet. But
no, true.
Yeah, I mean that was those were bloody fantastic experiences. Massive, that experience.
And also remember, we had to kind of panic because we'd got into this tradition now of. Well, I say we'd got into the tradition. We'd done it once of providing baked goods to our audience
in
the early slot at Lowlands. So I had to actually ask Ruben's manager to get us some Cranton Bollen locally because we had no time to pick up anything.
That's what a good manager does. He sources Cranton Bollen in Austin, you know?
Yeah, and he showed up with these massive bin liners of these things.
In fact, our tour manager, Rich, says that didn't somebody meet their wife at that gig?
Yeah, the first time we did this.
Because Timmy threw a bun and it went down a girl's top and the guy next to...
He threw the bun, right. Yeah, he threw the bun and it went down a girl's top and, yeah, they had a little chat. And
the boy next to him was like, oh, you know, and she was like, well, you could, you know, get it or
you
something.
You could try and retrieve it.
Ended up marrying each other. There we go. Bringing families together. It's a beautiful thing. Yeah, I mean, that was amazing. And, you know, I mean, festivals are great. So actually, we were honing the album at festivals. And
yeah,
they're the toughest gigs you're gonna do. Everyone has these great memories of festivals because it's very rare that you'll do a tour and play to 10,000 people and it's your headline slot. When you do a festival, you can play to 10,000 people and there'll be Muse fans, Warpaint fans, James Blake fans, Foo Fighters fans, everybody's fans milling around. So you get that big gig experience, but without they're all your fans thing. It's really brilliant, but you don't get a sound check unless you're Coldplay. And even if you're Coldplay, someone else does your sound check. You're in another country at that point, probably having just got off stage. So there's no sound check. It's a quick line check. And so your sound isn't going to be a nice, comfortable mix of your own stuff that you do every night. It's going to be like you, like it was at the beginning. Quick line check, everything working, okay, 3, 2, 1, and you're off. And I think that the great festival leveler is that everyone has the same experience. Everyone else on the bill has the same gig. And every festival is so monumentally different in so many ways that you just don't know what you're going to get. Every day you wake up at a different festival going like, I wonder what today is. Was it going to rain? Yeah. Is it going to be hot? Are we going to get to see a band we love? It's just so, especially for us, because we love music. We love live music. So especially for me and Timmy, it's like being, you know, it's like being a pig in shit when we go to a festival. Because, yeah, we're going to do the gig and we're going to play the songs and it's going to be really cool. But then it's like, oh, my God, who do we want to see? I mean, look at all these bands. Yeah. Oh, my God, there's so many bands we want to see.
It was during this period when we played a festival in Eastern Germany and there was I think they were from Zambia, a band after us.
Oh, yeah, I cried at that. That was really deep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Karlsruhe.
Oh, Rudelstad. Wasn't it Rudelstad?
Rudelstad, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, it was like a world music festival that was that every year specialised in a different country. And the year that we played it, it specialised in Zambian music, and which, of course, I love, randomly enough, because of John Peel, who is also a big fan of Zambian music.
Sure.
So... that was a monumental show. I really cried my eyes out. It was amazing.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. You have those experiences at festivals,
sure.
Don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And that first summer was a blend of festivals and promo stuff. I remember there being all sorts of little bits and pieces that we had to do. And then we had to pop a festival in. Then we had to get back on the promo circuit, you know.
Yeah.
And you and I had that crazy thing of having to do a couple of countries in the same day on planes. And then the one thing we didn't need was a 5-hour delay at Berlin Schönefeld, where we saw that football match where Germany destroyed Brazil.
Oh, yeah, right, we did. That's right. That was bonkers. Yeah, it's 2-0. It's 3-0. No, it's 5-0. Yeah, that was crazy. Yeah, I mean, that was... And the good thing about trying to get your songs together for a festival set is that if they work and you work out the peaks and the troughs and the beginnings and the endings, if they work after a line check at a festival in front of a couple of thousand, you know, 1975 fans, then, you know, it's gonna definitely pay dividends when you
do it on your own headline.
Hit proper stages, And I think when we went to do America, obviously the stages in America for us, even though we have stages to play, which is a really amazing thing and a rare achievement for any band, In New York, it's great. In LA, it's great. In Chicago, we've worked our way up and it's great. But everywhere else, you're pretty much playing a 300 to 700 cap indie venue. The luxury level is like, well, there is a room underneath that you can get changed in.
Yeah.
That's like the level of luxury.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, you're hitting that stage after playing these songs to 5,000 people at Lowlands.
Yeah.
And then now you're playing it to 200 people in Washington. And just like, I don't know, you just feel like, oh, we got this.
Yeah.
Adaptable, flexible. And as an old friend of mine, Semtex, a DJ in the UK, he once told me about DJing. Rule number one is know your songs.
Mm-hmm.
You got to know what's in your box. You got to know your song. When you DJ, you just know your material and then you'll be fine. And it's so true. After a festival tour and the festival set, you know your set.
Yeah.
When we hit America that year, the Splitter-tastic tour, you know, we knew what we were going to play.
Yeah.
And we tore some of those stages down, man. It was just such a great run.
It was. A decision that we made to A, start with America, but B, take Lamposaurus back to America, to America for the first time, because we'd never done it on the Perfect Darkness era.
Yeah.
So we kind of just went for it. We thought we were going to take them a full show. Four of us, Ruben didn't come, the three of us plus Chris, plus RG doing Lamposaurus. We didn't have a tour manager on the tour. That was the one concession. Simon, who we will introduce properly in a second, he did it remotely.
He prepped it, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. But we had a pallet shipped out to America with all of Lamposaurus and all of our gear on, which we had to go and pick up from this Enormo warehouse in New Jersey.
That was crazy, wasn't it?
Yeah. Which apparently is where every European band starts their tour in New Jersey. It's like a thing. It's a kind of cliche that, you know, there's a motel in New Jersey where everyone starts because that's where they pick up all their gear from and the hire vans and everything.
Is that the same motel that we stayed in that had the giant cake that was playing that Coldplay song on repeat the whole time we were there?
Exactly that.
Yeah. Paradise, man. That was just fucking everywhere. It was omnipresent. It was like the Eye of Mordor scanning us everywhere we went. That and an Adele single.
So we had that, and then we picked up all our stuff, and it was amazing the first time in Philadelphia that we set up. And we set up Lamposaurus and RG flicked the on switch and it just went bing. And we were like, oh my God, it works.
So
that's
good.
Insane.
I mean, we toured. It meant we had to have a U-Haul running. We had a splitter van and a U-Haul. So the splitter van had us and all the us and some gear.
Yes.
And the U-Haul, which we named Camel Toe, rather, because it had a big camel on it.
That's
and
right.
RG would... That was his vehicle.
RG and Chris.
Because RG and Chris, because one, these are two very unlikely friends to share a 17-hour drive with, but RG loves all kinds of music.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and Chris will like, he can find something to like in almost anything.
Yeah.
But the funniest moment with the U-Haul, because what you would do is the U-Haul would only go up to like 80 kilometers an hour or like 60 miles an hour. So RG would jam the accelerator down with like a shoe.
Yeah.
And they would just hang and play. But one day early on in the tour, they didn't secure the door. Do you remember?
My
and
God.
All of our luggage just spilled out of the back on the highway.
Oh,
it was
my
all
God,
over the highway. Man, the argument was who's supposed to lock the door? Who didn't padlock the door?
Oh,
man,
that was
a life-threatening moment.
I know. And RG had to cross three lanes of traffic to pick up a suitcase.
God,
or something.
Dude.
Yeah, he was running around in the road and some American fella pulled over and said, buddy, what the hell are you doing? He's like, our suitcases fall out the back. And the man said, you really can't be doing this, mate.
If the cops come,
they're going to kill you.
No, that was intense. That U-Haul tour, it was awesome to be driving the splitter, which was faster and much more luxurious than the U-Haul, to be fair. And then an hour later, the U-Haul would pull up, RG and Chris, you know, dude, and then we'd be rocking and rolling. Good times, man.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah,
I mean,
it was good.
We wanted to look, with any territory, any band at any stage in their career, you want to keep adding to your territories and your lists and the people who come to your show. So with America, what generally tends to happen is New York, LA, in our case, Montreal, Toronto, you know, and Chicago, they kind of pay for the rest of the tour.
Yeah.
But you're not going to go home with any money. So don't think you're going to be making cash here. You're not. You definitely do it for the love and the experience, because I remember the profit on that tour equaled the U-Haul and RG.
Did it really?
So like almost dollar for dollar. Like the profit was $17,000 and the U-Haul plus RG was $17,000. So it was kind of like we definitely toured at cost, but we were like, no, we want to open up markets. Yeah, yeah. We want to open up these places. We want to play Philly. We want to play Washington. We want to play like everywhere. We want to play absolutely everywhere.
There's a ton of promo you get as well on the way around. You stop at all these nice radio stations, like that one we played in Boston. We played a full filmed session, I think it was in Boston, and it's got a really good version of Looking Too Closely, which is up on YouTube to this day, right. You know, the three of us plus Chris.
Nice.
And you don't get that kind of thing if you just stay home, obviously.
No.
And that's the kind of thing that gets watched, you know, all the way around.
I mean, it is a hard sell. I remember on that tour, I got out of the van, out of the splitter van, this big black Mercedes Vito type splitter van. And we were in some service station, like literally in the middle of nowhere. And I was wearing like combats and a sort of puffer jacket. And we found out later, after I was talking to some old people in the car park, they were like, you're out here, you know, chasing the ducks, huh? And I'm like, no, we're a band on tour, obviously. Look at how I'm dressed, kind of a vibe. And it's like, yeah, I look like a duck hunter, basically, in their eyes. And I was on a duck. And of course, I was getting out of a massive blacked out van wearing combats. They obviously thought I'm hunting stuff. And I just thought, wow, this is That's a so different funny. World.
Different world, I know, totally.
But, you know, it's funny how English people, definitely me in particular, definitely get more English the more deep into America you get. I remember we had to pull over at a place called Custer. Where we had to fill up the van with petrol because we were running out, and we stopped in this real one horse town type petrol station where the owner was wearing dungarees and his son was wearing dungarees, and it was kind of one of these moments, and I did kind of go, oh, hello, we need some fuel for our lovely wagon vehicle, we're touring America, jolly good. And you know, you just get more English the more intense it gets. But yeah, the miles, the mileage, and also the feeling that we were giving the Americans first option, just to sort of say,
nice.
You know, they didn't know we weren't making any money. Mm-hmm. We did. And it's like, we're giving America the most show we can possibly afford to give you. And almost in a kind of like, thanks for sticking with us, even though we've toured you as an afterthought after Europe all these years. It's just nice that we could like go with it. And we'd had a few sinks by then, so we found that the audiences were there, not because we'd had radio, because we don't do AAA American radio stuff, but because we'd had some sinks, which kind of acted like having AAA radio.
So, Warm Shadow was basically a hit single, in a sense.
That's the thing. So when we'd hit the tracks in our set that were the sink monsters, that they'd be the ones that got the big reactions. And we could literally tell why we were in America, why we were selling venues out. It was because of Yesterday Was Hard and All of Us got that sync with Suits. Warm Shadow got that sync on Walking Dead, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like the sync tracks were fueling this tour, which was a really beautiful feeling to think, we are moving the needle over here. It's just, it's a big needle.
Those songs travel. They really do. This is the tour as well where we came up with this concept of the 90 minutes that you're on stage are not only the best bit of the day, but actually the most relaxing part of the day.
Yeah.
Because it was during the time when, I don't think we should go into full detail, but our van was giving us a load of hassle.
Yeah.
And it was just a nightmare. We were kind of at the point of thinking, we literally don't know how we're going to get to Toronto the next day because this van is being so annoying.
Let me just quickly fill in a gap there. It was about this diesel blue fluid. And when your big splitter van runs out of diesel blue fluid, you get 7 ignition starts before it goes into limp mode. Limp mode is 30 miles an hour maximum. And when you've got a 17-hour drive from Minneapolis to Vancouver, that's not an option, by the way. So, and the problem is the van hire company we hired the van from, they bought their entire fleet at the same time. So every time we would go somewhere and replace the van, they'd give us another one, which would have the same problem pretty much within about 100 miles. So it was fucking insane. So there was this one moment where me and Timmy were like, okay, we've got 5 ignition starts. So we get there, we load in, that's 1. We load out, that's 2. We get to the motel, that's 3. We wake up the next day, that's 4. so we've got one spare to get us to the garage to get another van. It was getting to that level.
It was that level. And all they had to do in the end, we're going there now. We're telling the story.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. All we had to do was to, because we'd put this fluid in and it was fine, but it was the computer that was having the problem.
Yeah, it's the computer. So computer what
they,
says no.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What they needed to do was get someone senior enough in Mercedes to be able to ring Stuttgart at
the time,
get this particular code in order to reset the computer. And this was the most, you know, impossibly difficult task. In the end, we did it.
We went to a Mercedes dealership. We were at a Mercedes dealership. We were sat there.
In Montreal.
We were sat there for hours and hours and hours. And the guy said to us, the job is done. I mean, we can do the job in literally 5 seconds, but they had to wait for a fax from Stuttgart. Do you remember? It had to be faxed.
And
because of the time difference, it was just agonizing. We were sat there waiting for someone to just say, yeah, you may reset this.
Yeah, so there were a few sound checks that were pretty tight because of those shenanigans, right?
Definitely. But this particular day in Montreal, I remember getting on stage after this horrible kind of trying anything under the sun to get our van situation sorted, walking on stage and just thinking, ah, great. Now for 90 minutes, nothing can touch us.
No, just we play the gig.
Exactly. The next 90 minutes, you're in control. It's predictable. You know what's going to be happening. I know.
Yeah. No one's going to totally say, right. Guy can only be started 5 more times before he stops being able to play the bass.
I think he goes into limp mode. Yeah, I think we've been on limp mode for a while at this point anyway.
So, and also we should mention that accompanying us around America and indeed on most of the 90 gigs we did for Hard Believer was Douglas Dare.
Tour champion, and Fabian Prynne, tour champion. Prynne. Both of these guys, tour champions. And, you know, man, some of those, I mean, Douglas is great, you know, I mean, he's just so great. And he is who he is. He's relentlessly who he is. He's not cutting any corners here. He's definitely who he is. And, you know, yeah, he suffered all the ups and downs with us. He suffered Turf Club in Minneapolis, just like we did. He suffered that Mod Club in Toronto, sort of just like we did. But then he'd hit San Francisco and just, oh my God, nail it so hard. Hit LA and just give what needed to be given. And man, he was a tour beast, man. Absolutely.
They're both brilliant.
Was that the first tour with Douglas?
Yeah.
The American run?
Yeah. You're seeing him and Fabian load into Boston was the first time we ever met them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because that's really uptight, up close and personal. Splitter tour around America is there's no wiggle room there.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. That's just what I was going to say. If you're going to be cooped up in a van with some dudes for 26-hour journeys, then yeah, They better be nice guys. And luckily, perfect choices.
Yeah, that was a good choice. So yeah, we had them to look forward to for the next however many months. And also Simon De Winter, who was who'd been installed in the early summer as our new tour manager.
Yes, because we needed one at last. And it's almost like, as you said in previous chapters, we've tended to bolt great personnel on when we've actually really needed them, or when we've realized we just can't do this on our own anymore. And meeting Simon was a real game changer, because Simon De Winter was such a great tour manager and he'd done everything and done everybody. So it was just amazing that we felt, especially after that American tour, because nothing really went wrong that was within the realms of a tour manager.
Yeah.
We just sort of felt, wow, that worked.
Yeah.
And so when we came to Europe, you know, it was just like, okay, Simon's got it, man. This tour manager's going to tell us what to do, where to go, when to eat, when to shower.
Yeah.
And it's going to run relatively smoothly, which it did, which is brilliant.
And you'll probably notice that I'm using the word was, because sadly Simon is no longer with us.
Very sadly, yeah.
But the good thing about him was that, yes, he knew all this stuff, but he also wasn't some much older cigar smoking guy. You know, he was one of us, essentially, same age as us, same reference points, liked a few drinks, of course.
I mean, me and Simon had actually crossed paths a few times in the 90s in London.
Did you?
But without knowing each other. Yeah, we both went for the same job that he got.
Okay.
He got the job. It was an A&R guy for Gut Records.
Ah, right.
So I went for the same interview for the same job and was like, I've got to get this job. It's going to be so bloody amazing. Anyway, it turns out Simon De Winter got it. But we were probably crossed paths literally in that building getting interviewed for that job. So
right.
Yeah, we kind of, Simon was just so fantastic. And for us, as a band that was so used to trying to find our own solutions in the dark, not really knowing what to do, it was amazing to have someone to ask, dude, how do we solve this one? He'd be like, well, I know, funnily enough, I know someone that can do that, or I can do that, or, you know, I've got a van and I've got a weekend, so we can do it like that. Or, was like, he was all solutions all the time. And that's exactly what a tour manager needs to be.
He could even fix a zip, which is quite something. Like, I've got a massive hardware bag that has a big industrial sized zip, and this zip gave up like halfway through the tour, and I said, oh no, I'm gonna have to get a new protection racket bag. And Simon went, I can fix that. And next thing I know, he's pulling out a soldering iron and what have you, and he's literally fixing my zip by melting some of it.
That's so great. And so on this tour, we felt like we had a real crew. We had tour manager, we had monitors.
Karima, the monitor.
Karima was amazing, yeah. You know, utterly amazing. Like just tour companion, because it's important that the people you're going to be sharing a very small space with for the next 3 months are people that aren't assholes, really.
Yeah,
And, you know, we really struck out, because we've always been this way, to be honest, and I'd like to think that we still are in some respect. But, you know, we don't want to tour with assholes. We want to tour with people we like, because we love working with friends. So if we like take someone like Karima, for example, who's become a lifelong friend for all of us, I'm sure, you know, she was just A, great at what she did, and B, really easy to be with.
Yeah.
Those are two like massive things when you're on a bus together.
And also, this tour was what they'd been asking us to do for ages, which is a kind of three-part monster.
Yeah, don't go home tour, basically.
Yeah, so all the A-list cities, then all the tertiary markets, and then a kind of proper victory lap at the very end with a festival season. So I think we say in the book that Hard Believer had about 105 gigs in the whole.
So many.
Something like that.
Because it's like, you know, a lot of bands, and fair enough too, they only have the time to do primaries. So they'll do Paris, Amsterdam, Brussels, you know, Berlin, maybe Frankfurt. And they don't do the B-list venues, which are essential to build, like to really, truly build your fan base, you know. And it's where festivals kind of feed into it, because when you do festivals, you touch people that come from everywhere. You're not just playing to people in Nice when you play there. You're playing to people from all over France. And Germany's got an unlimited amount of places to play, and so is France, and so is Italy, and Spain, and everywhere else. So you basically, you have to hit the primaries and a few others in between, but then, you know, you need to come back and steel yourself up to do the B lists, you know, and get those done. And then, of course, you have Asia and Australia and South Africa and Russia and.
But the B list is where the fun is, in a way.
Absolutely, man.
Like that the B list run in the spring of 2015. I think that's possibly my favorite tour ever. Not because it was particularly enjoyable, but just because you can sit back and say, I did that. And we sort of drove ourselves to the kind of extremes of...
To the edge.
Yeah. I mean...
It was the B-list tour when we had the tyre blowout in Greece.
Yes.
Because that was when Frank the Driver... I remember Frank the Driver, another character on this tour, when he picked us up from the airport, wherever that... Maybe it was in Berlin, I don't know. But we had to fly somewhere, and when we met him at the airport, and we walked behind him like a bunch of little ducklings, and he was like the big duck. Yeah. and he would waddle to the bus like, you know, Frank was a giant scary man in black that hated music, hated humanity, hated everyone and everything, but actually underneath he had a heart of gold. I don't know if that's true. I'm projecting that is definitely true. So that I can sleep at night. But Frank was like, he was a legend, and one of his best driver we ever had, amazing, amazing nightliner driver. And, you know, we thought to ourselves, okay, one of the things about Frank is that, one of the things about bus drivers is, you know, they do talk, you know, and they talk. Some bus drivers, you think, yeah, you know, I bet this is a bit exaggerated, you know. But with Frank, you always kind of thought, probably not. So when we had a tyre blowout in Greece, we all heard this fucking enormous explosion from under the bus. I mean, it's really noisy. Do you remember that? It felt
like
the bomb had gone off under the bus.
It is like a bomb, yeah.
And it was one of the inside tires of the bus. because the bus has two sets of wheels on each side. You only see one, but there's two in there. And we were like, oh my God, we're screwed. And Frank and the second driver, they used the hydraulics of the bus to lean the bus over enough so that they could crawl under 27 tons of bus by hand, get this tire out, put a new tire in. Man, it was like,
it was amazing.
It was insane. I'd never seen anything like it. Frank was such a warrior. I felt like he could lift that bus. Well, and he was at one point literally lifting it up so the second driver could get under the bus, I might add, and like, you know, fix the and get a new tire in there. But man, it was
God, it was insane.
I think did Croatia happen on that B run?
Yeah,
was that Zagreb?
Zagreb, yeah, that was the snow pushing the bus out of the snow gate.
This was where we melted Frank's heart, and you know, because Frank had a heart that was surrounded by, you know, a fortress of heavily armed, you know, hate weapons. Very difficult to get into Frank's good books.
Yeah.
And we did this gig in Zagreb and we parked the bus in a field, thought nothing of it, loaded in, did the gig, came out, it was cold, came out of the show, foot of snow, bus is in a snowy field and it's not going anywhere. It's completely stuck. It's completely fucking stuck in this field. And that's it. They tried everything they could to get it out. But, you know, the bus wasn't moving. So we eventually, all of us, all the crew, anyone around, we eventually ended up pushing the bus physically by hand backwards out of this field.
Didn't it take
which is
some
no mean...
convincing, though, as well? Yeah, you had to actually convince him that this was possible.
Oh, no, yeah, no, he shouted, you're going to push my fucking bus out the window like you bunch of idiots.
Yeah.
You've lost your minds. But we'd gone through stages. We'd loaded up with the trailer on the back. It hadn't moved. We'd taken the trailer off, emptied it, wheeled the empty trailer 200 yards out of the field, loaded it again on the other side, and then tried the bus again. And at that point, Frank said, you're going to push my fucking bus. And there were literally fans,
everyone,
crew, promoter, yeah, everybody.
Because,
literally,
I mean,
it was ridiculous. Except not quite everyone. There were two people still sat
who didn't
but we
do
won't
it.
Go on.
Who was it? Was it Douglas and Fabian?
No, Douglas was... No, it wasn't.
Fabian wasn't with us at that point.
Was it RG and Rob on the bus?
Rob was on the bus, yeah.
Rob was on the bus.
Yeah, 50%. But not RG. RG was pushing in the snow, bro.
It was awesome. So,
but anyway, let's not go there.
So we wouldn't want Rob to push the bus. It would be it's fair enough.
But exactly.
Yeah, we did push the bus. And we rocked the bus out of its little rut.
Yeah.
And then the bus was moving. Yeah. And the reason why we had to do this was because the next day was a day off. And on this tour, every day off was like absolute gold.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of us needed a shower and a bit of private time. And it's like, we have to get out of here. But there's no way this is not happening. And so when the bus moved out of that field,
yeah.
Oh my God, Frank... We were friends after that.
Yeah.
He was just blown away. This has never happened.
He was blown away.
Yeah, he was so...
Yeah, the next morning I had a ciggy with him and he said, I've been driving buses for however many years you've been driving buses for. He said, I have never even heard of anyone attempting to push a Nightliner out of a snow drifty field. And I cannot believe you idiots did it.
Oh, man.
It was brilliant.
I just love the fact that... Frank was able to stride out into traffic and just yell stop if he wanted to get the traffic to stop so he could reverse out of somewhere.
I like Frank massively. I got on really, really well with Frank. I was still a heavy smoker at those times, so I sat up the front smoking with him pretty much permanently on those journeys.
Well, you and, get to know the bus drivers better than anyone, I feel, in a way.
I do. I very much do. It's my smoking habits and the fact that the only place that you can smoke on buses these days is up front if the driver allows it, and that's a 80% success rate on that being allowed, I'd say. But yeah, absolutely.
Sure.
I do, and I love Frank, still do, still think he's a funny dude. He was a great guy. I mean, yeah, scary for sure. I mean, don't want to get him angry.
No, but
he had some history, he had some stories. They've all got stories.
Oh God, yeah, they do. That's the thing, they really do.
But I wonder going forward if this will continue because I've quit smoking. I'm gonna miss the days of chatting to the drivers up
you'll
front.
Find some way again. Of getting in there with them. I should think, you know, you'll bond over.
It's either either you go to the cab and sit with the driver guy and discuss what you discuss with drivers, or you sit in the common room with Tim and Argy listening to ABBA or whatever they're playing on the stereo. I think you'll probably spend a lot of time in the cab.
I'll take the driver. Yeah, they really appreciate if homogenous lump of them. Those guys really appreciate if you go up front and just check if they want a coffee or something. I think that makes a massive difference. And it's not pretentious. I think we've always been a band that really likes to, like you say, Finn, everyone's got to be looked after and we want a nice crew of non-arseholes. So when we don't get to pick the driver, that's the one thing we have absolutely no say in, isn't it?
Yeah,
we
can
pick all the crew, pick the engineers, pick everybody. And so I really feel it's very key to get drivers on, you know, who are nice and if everyone's going to get along.
Well, it's
important.
It's rule number one, isn't it? Happy driver, happy bus. You know, it's
totally.
Piss off the driver, you know, that's we've been on buses where we've pissed off the driver or the driver is just pissed off, and it's not a safe environment to be in.
It's not.
Be honest.
It's unpleasant. Yeah, totally.
Our double-decker bus. I remember when we got the bus back to Absolute Touring after this mammoth A-list, B-list, festy season, Hard Believer run. And we calculated that the bus itself, as a bus, not on our tour, but as just the general bus, had done so many miles that it had done the equivalent of going to the moon and back and then round the earth a couple of times.
Really?
in kilometres. Yeah, because I said to Marco at Absolute, you know, how many miles has this bus done? And he said, well, he's already gone round the ticker, already gone round once.
Right.
And now it's on the second 500,000 or whatever it is. And he's like, with the engines, they're just basic diesel engines. And if you service them properly, they'll just run forever, like a steam train. If you service it, this will just run for the rest of time. And everything else just falls off eventually. You change the windscreen wipers and you change the wing mirrors and stuff. But the engine will never end. And this bus has just been on the road for, 15 years constantly.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing.
It was amazing. Yeah, it was home from home, that bus.
We liked it so much that we wrote the track listing in it Horizontalism album.
We did, because when you travel in the winter, your bus gets covered in salt. If you're in a white bus, you don't really notice. And we did tour in a white bus once, and it always looked really nice. But when you tour in a big black bus, all the salt from the motorways just covers your bus. And before Frank was just about to wash it, and me and Timmy were like, no, stop, don't wash it. We've got to quickly write a track listing on the side of it. And yet another one of these incidents where your bus driver looks at you as if to say, God, musicians, they're so full of shit. Oh, God, when is this going to end? These idiots, you know.
Oh, man, I know. Oh, God.
Bless him. But yeah, that tour was monumental, as well as all the big shows, which were just amazing, and the small shows, some of which I remember, normally for the wrong reasons, but they're all happy memories. I think when you finish a tour that long and you've played that many shows, because we do sort of four on one off in those days, I think, didn't we?
That three month run was 5 days, I think, brother. I think it was 5 days on, 1 day off. And to be honest, you know, so even some of our long-serving crew said they'd never done a three-month tour of not going home once and doing 5 days on, 1 day off. It was a good, solid lump of hard touring, man.
This is definitely where... This is the tour I did the Shan technique, I think, wasn't it?
Remind me what the Shan technique is.
Well, I mean, because... There are several
Shan techniques.
It's a myth. The Shan technique, it turns out, is a myth. But it was like one tour, Shan didn't take any PDs. And then she had them all at the end of the tour, and it's like a big load of cash in an envelope. It turns out that actually never happened. But in my mind, it did. So I called it the Shan technique.
Well, she said it only happened accidentally.
Right.
Like, she just forgot to take PDs.
Because when you're in a touring band, PDs are like the money you get for free. It's tax free, it's cash, and it's your money to buy like food with if you need to buy food. And it's about 20 euros a day, or if you're on a big tour, maybe 50 euros a day. I don't know. But on our tour, I think it was 20 euros a day.
Yeah.
And so you kind of line up like you're at school getting your milk, and the tour manager makes you sign, you know, the ledger of evil truths, and then he gives you your couple of days PDs, 20 euros, 60 euros, or whatever. But I was like, no, I'm going to survive on the riders. I'm going to eat, you know, bananas and, you know, ham sandwiches. Yes. And then at the end of the tour, I'm going to sign all the pages and get it all in one massive hit, which was amazing.
I know.
It was amazing.
It was good. I remember you like talking about discussing what you were going to do with your bounty at the very end.
Yeah.
You know.
I think, Finn, you told me you were going to blow it all on vinyl. You were like, I'm going to take this.
I did.
PD cash.
I started the tradition that I have now of every tour, I take 10% of the profit and spend it on records at the end of it for myself. And I started that tradition on the Hard Believer tour.
It's like a vinyl tax you've imposed.
Yeah, like it's kind of cool, like, actually. Dude, what? Because, you know, why'd you do this? And I pick a genre and then I go on, I go on Discogs within the genre and take my 10% of the tour profit and be like, right, okay, what nuggets, what rare stuff do I really, really want? I mean, you know.
That's totally fair, bloody hell.
I think
it's a good way of doing it. It's a really good way
Otherwise, your money just gets absorbed in, you know, paying for, the bills or the water bill or your accountant or I don't know. And you just need to treat yourself because if you're a musician, let's say in my case, I'm a guitarist, buying a new guitar doesn't give me the thrill because it's like for work.
Yeah.
You've got to spend it on something that isn't tax deductible, basically.
Yes,
otherwise,
of
course. It doesn't count. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so it should be like a holiday or in my case, even more vinyl that I don't need. But
so I'm just going to do a quick quiz with Guy here. Finn, you might know as well. There's another two things on tour that are also described as the Sean method. Can you remember what they are? Guy, is Guy gone?
Guy's gone. He's left the building. So we can finally finally talk about how we replayed all of his bass on Hard Believer.
Oh well, I mean, he won't remember this anyway because he's got a rubbish memory. The other
is
two.
Is it something to do with telling the sound guy? Is it giving the sound guy the silent treatment because he says something sexist?
Well, that's yet another one. No, what it is. If you're going to move your hi-hat, you close it and shut it first.
Oh, yes, of course, because she was all edumacated at school for music, wasn't she?
Exactly, yeah. So
she taught you so much about the drums.
Absolutely, yeah. Like, so you don't want to move a hi-hat when it's open because it'll go...
Exactly.
So that's the first thing. The other thing is when you're putting your bass drum back
in the case. I remember this lesson.
You put the bass drum down on the floor and then you pick up the case and do it top load.
I mean, it sounds obvious now.
Yes.
But we toured for like 8 years, putting the bag on the floor and putting the kick drum on the bag and then wriggling and swearing.
It's just a nightmare. I know, totally. Yeah, so Sean is very, very useful. In fact, we ought to mention that on the final leg of the Hard Believer tour, Sean wasn't the merch girl. Sean was drumming in She Drew the Gun, who are our support band.
That's right. She Drunk the Rider.
Yeah, She Drunk the Rider. That's what we called
that's
them.
That's right, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's true.
That was a great...
I remember Sean, when we were out with Rachel Samani, that was a Perfect Darkness tour, wasn't it? And Sean was outside the old Batch Cap, which in Frankfurt, which had the merch outside.
Outside, yeah, that's right.
And so, which is fine in the summer.
Yeah.
But in November, it's not so fine. And
they just dealt with it by getting sloshed, I think.
Yeah, they did. Sean and Rachel just basically got absolutely red wined up to the max to warm themselves up while they did the merch outside. But, you know, Sean was just a warrior, you know.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what you need. That's what you need from your... Because, you know, even the term, you know, merch girl, such bullshit.
So reductive.
When you're selling the merch, you know, you're the one that has to sit in the public from the minute the doors open. So you're sat there from 7 until the last member of the public's left the building and then you can pack down the stall. So essentially you're sat outside in a foyer for like sometimes 4.5 hours.
Yeah.
You know. And everyone else is having fun, having a beer, having a coffee, having a nap. Yeah, you're not. You're sat on the merch stall saying, yes, this is the latest album. No, we don't have that on vinyl. No, I'm sorry, we don't have any larges left.
Yeah,
you know, literally.
And then you
months.
Have to endure you and me arriving after the show and everything going bonkers. All your sort of carefully worked out methods of where you're putting the change and where you're putting this. We show up to sign some stuff, and suddenly everything goes out the window. I start taking money from people and not writing what I've sold down. You know,
buck the system and annoy the hell out of everybody. Absolutely,
it's true.
Totally.
But then some nights I do remember maybe in some of the smaller places where we would dawdle a little because we may be a little fatigued with the grin and grabs routine after and doing the merch. And so maybe on the fifth night of a long run in a cold part of Eastern Europe or something, and we'd go out and there'd be nobody there.
True.
And we'd be like, oh. And then Sean would say, well, if you'd have been here 15 minutes ago, dude, you would have sold a lot more fucking T-shirts. And you're like, yeah, that's very, very true. But yeah, man, I mean, we should also mention that touring is also about pacing yourself.
Yes.
And on these kind of runs, anything over 3 weeks, you've got to pace yourself. It might be all fun and exciting on the first couple of nights. Oh, I'm going to drink a beer that I shouldn't because it's a bit late. But you've got to pace yourself because
big time.
There will be another gig tomorrow and another gig the day after and another gig the day after. And this is kind of why I think lead singers become a bit like monks on tour sometimes, because you're like, man, I've got to do this every night.
Yeah,
and there's nowhere to hide and nowhere to run and nowhere to escape to. And, you know, I can't hit the stage tomorrow because every time you do a gig, you lose, let's say, 10%. Mm. So after five gigs in a row, you're running at 50% and you have to spend all of that doing the show. You begin to run out of bandwidth to run basic functions of your life, like relationships back home or being friendly to your band, you know, and shit like that. You just... You're running on empty pretty much most of the time.
Yeah, yeah.
You're saving everything for the show. I remember the one mantra that we all have on tours, especially back then, was if you're injured, will it affect the gig? Do you remember? So if Tim cut his thumb or Guy fell over or something, it was like, is it going to affect the show? Like proper Spinal Tap style. If it's not going to affect the show, you're not ill enough to worry about. Let's just carry on.
Yeah.
I mean, do you remember though that in the old days, days off would be considered an opportunity to party? So you'd hit there, you'd do three or four gigs, and then you'd get a day off in a hotel. And when we were younger, certainly me, that would be but that's the day you go out and go absolutely mad. You hit, you know, the days Six Nations was on, me, Simon, and Chris would head out, find an Irish pub in Hungary, and you're absolutely fucking hammered by 6 p.m. And you swiftly realize on these tours, in terms of pacing yourself, that is a bad idea. As time goes on, you need to take that day to chill. You can't have a hangover on the next day of the first gig of a run of five. It's a stupid plan.
Yeah,
I would always spend my days off on this run, and I still do, I think, to a certain extent. I would find, I'd Google, you know, all the secondhand record stores in whatever tiny Dorf Veal we were in, and just be like, okay, where are the records at? And then it would just mean that I would just get up slowly, do my workouts and my routines or whatever, find a little shop. It would take me into the village or the town or the city we were in. It's a good excuse to get in there and, you know, and find somewhere that's a bit off the beaten track and maybe find some records. And it's just nice to just have a little day of just trying, in my case, trying not to talk to anyone, give the voice a moment to settle.
And just
relax. It's hard to relax when you're on stage.
I just want to point out though that on the day off thing, that sometimes, as we all know, a day off is not a day off. A day off is actually a travel day. To where, and I remember particularly when we were playing in Kiev and then we had a day off and then we were playing in Bucharest. So the plan, as usual, was to leave Kiev after the gig, drive like hell, get to Bucharest at some acceptable time the next day, and have a day off. All right. We were still driving to Bucharest at about 3 a.m. the following day.
Yeah.
So the day of the, because we had border shenanigans. It turns out Ukraine is much bigger than we thought it was.
Yeah, no doubt.
And I remember, like, the whole day was spent on the bus just driving to Bucharest, and we were being really kind of careful because we thought, well, we can't just go nuts with this because we can't just like get drunk on the bus because we're going to feel awful the next
day. Absolutely, absolutely. And we should point out that one of the rules of the bus is if you're going to be sick, you have to be sick into your own hand luggage.
Oh, God, yeah. Or something that you find, you know. So, yeah, being drunk on the bus is not.
Oh, it's horrible. I think I've been drunk on the bus maybe twice.
Yeah.
First time I was like, I'm never doing this again. The second time I was like, this is never happening again.
Yeah.
Because it's just, there's nowhere that you can't get some fresh air. You can't go for a walk and you can't be sick.
So I remember saying to myself, well, around about this time we were doing some little videos saying, hey, this is Fink, we're really looking forward to playing in insert name of German city. And I was making a sort of little video for each one. And I said, right, I'm going to do my work. I'm going to finish making this particular video that I'm making. And then after that, I'm going to have a drink. And this was going to be about 9 p.m. And we were still bloody well driving to Bucharest. And finished up at 9 p.m. And Guy brought his bottle of Danish aquavit out. And we all proceeded to just drink this thing. And we had a massive Spotify off and drink this thing. And we arrived, we all fell asleep in our chairs.
Oh, shame on you.
Arrived in Bucharest at 4 a.m., went to bed for a nice kind of 5 hours sleep, and then got up and went and sound checked.
That's the
and
thing.
That was our day off.
I do remember another day off we had in Munich, where it's a classic band day off problem, where you arrive at the hotel you're supposed to check into at like 10:30 in the morning, and they're like, no, we haven't got any rooms until 3. And then you've got a really moody band and crew on a bus that they've been on for 12 hours, just being like, well, that's fucking great, isn't it? So we hit Munich, and then we all went to the massive beer halle, which is really famous there, and had like many, many beers because it's a day off and there was nothing we could do. And we had to kill 5 hours. And that was like, and it was open at 10:30 in the morning. So you could go to this Munich beer hall and literally have a liter of beer that was fresh and cold and lovely and yummy and served by some fancy dress wench with a pretzel and a bust and just be like, oh my God. And so, I remember Chris and Ruben got absolutely slaughtered that morning.
Yeah.
It was royal.
Me too. That was my birthday.
Oh, was it?
My wife, I came back, just couldn't wait to collapse in my room at 3 p.m. as soon as it was open. We were absolutely hammered. And I just collapsed in my bed, and then I woke up having jet lagged myself. Now I've slept for like 12 hours. I woke up at 3 a.m. feeling like absolute crap with all these messages from my wife just getting increasingly angry. Starts off going, happy birthday, hope you're having a nice day off. And then in the middle, it's sort of like, okay, you haven't called me back now, I've rung you a few times, hope everything's good. And finishes up with you better be fucking dead or in jail, I swear to God.
And totally fair enough too. And totally fair enough too. I'm sure when you said to her, oh, look, babe, I got up and I just got really fucking shit-faced in a bar. Sorry. I'm sure she was like, oh, cool. Okay. Well, yeah, no worries.
Well, I explained. We got dumped in the... I was actually... it was worse than a bus even, because Frank dumped us in the hotel lobby at 7:30 a.m. and drove away. So there wasn't...
That's
even,
right,
we were just sat in the lobby. And it was Argy said, beer hallows open at 10:30 here, guys. And we all went, done. Jumped in cabs and off we went.
Because that's the thing about the bus driver. They're driving their hotel, so they can't wait to offload you out the front of the local travelodge and bugger off to their own devices.
Very true. Yeah. They do love dumping a band and driving away, which is fair enough.
It is.
Yeah, but you're right. That is such a hotel room conundrum. That's true on tour. That is. I've forgotten the horror of no rooms till 2 p.m.
Speaking of the... bus driver dumping the band and driving off. We should probably
dump this podcast and drive off.
We've been
awesome. Let me just unhitch the podcast from the back of the bus and
push it out of the snow.
Leave it in an alley somewhere.
Were you about to say one more thing, Finn? Sorry, I thought you were interrupting.
Anything else about the Hard Believer tour? No, apart from the fact of we thought that when we came back from. We shouldn't say victory lap with any kind of, it was a small victory. The victory was simply surviving and playing lots of gigs and no one got hurt. So the victory lap was just extended a very, very long tour. But it was just awesome to get home after almost 18 months on the road, pretty much constantly, almost.
Yeah.
And just think, you know, wow, that actually did just happen. And a lot of change in that period for me personally, just because it does when you don't water your plants, they wither and die. And that also goes for your own life, I guess. But, you know, just getting back from that tour, just thinking, wow, we just did that. And there aren't many bands that we know at our level that have done it. Like, we all know that Coldplay or Ed Sheeran or Iron Maiden or whatever, they tour for years and da 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 da. But an indie band on a bus for that long, I don't know. It did feel like we'd done something that we don't know many bands that have actually done that again. You know.
Yeah.
Was this the first time? I think this might be the first time that I felt when we finished a tour of an album, for the first time ever, I thought, we deserve a sustained period of chill. You know, normally we'd come home and be like, right, next record, next thing, got to get going, get doing another record so we can go back out on tour. Yeah. I think this was the first time that I thought, right, we might not speak to each other for a sustained period of months now, just to catch our breath.
Oh, what a beautiful thing.
Precisely. Yeah. But we had finally earned it, I think, right? We had done enough work to buy a little buffer of, like famous rock bands do, have a little downtime.
Yeah. I think the victory lap was called the Fall Into the Light tour, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's what we named it kind of unofficially because
horizontalism.
So because I'd actually done an album on the road while we were on tour.
Yeah. The remix,
I took a moment, but then I quickly launched into something else because like anything, like any other touring band, you need a break, but you don't need a very long break. You just need enough time to go, oh, and then immediately you're like, okay, when can I start that carousel
That's
again?
True.
You know, like how do we?
Yeah, you went and did blues. Is that the when you did the blues?
Yeah, I jumped right into all that. But yeah, so I mean, yeah, we came to the end of the Hard Believer tour, and we'd had a hit single, and we'd done the big tour, and it's kind of like this is what we wanted to do. This It Isn't Until It Is arc of like the first 10 years, because it did start in a bedroom, and it did end on big stages, you know, doing encores, and you know, it's a bit like a movie, a very, very, very long and boring movie at times. But you know, that's kind of why we wanted to pick the first 10 years, isn't it, really? Because we wanted it to end this little retrospective moment on a bit of a high, really.
Yeah, a bit of a high. Yeah, exactly. And I think we should say that there'll be more of our reflections on the entire story in episode nine.
So the next episode will be more of a kind of, we don't really know because we're going to be off the grid.
You'll wing it.
It's an epilogue. Is it like an epilogue?
Epilogue, yeah.
Like an epilogue.
It's like an epilogue. Nice. And that's when, we can talk about, we'll discuss. We ought to finish
we'll
this
discuss
one.
What, we'll think we'll discuss what we're going to discuss when we have a discussion about it before the next podcast. But until then, that's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from him.
Love that.
Lovely.
And you, Guy. Sorry.
And
it doesn't
me.
Work with three See, people, that.
Yeah. And Guy.
It doesn't. And them.
Yeah. It's goodbye from them and goodbye from they.
Perfect.
Excellent.